Welcome to this Rosen lecture. My name is Andrew Byrne. I have the great pleasure of being the co-director of one of the organisations that sponsors this lecture series, which is an organisation called DARE, Digital Arts Research Education. But it's strongly infested by kind of English drama and media teachers, I have to say, although technically its remit goes across the arts in education. So we're one of the sponsors of the series, and we try and run one every year. The other sponsors are UKLA and NAIT, who each also sponsor one at their annual conferences. So I think this is the seventh one. In fact, I might have got that wrong. I'm not very good at counting. That's why I became an English teacher. Sorry. But if you go to the DARE website, which is www.darecollaborative.net, you can see all of them listed there, and they've all been audio recorded as well, so you can listen to all of them. And they're a very interesting assortment. Michael Rosen fittingly did the first one, and he also actually did the most recent one as well, which was at the conference earlier this year. So you can hear them, and if you don't want to listen to all of them, you can listen to the first 5 minutes, and typically there's an interesting tribute to Harold in the first 5 minutes of one of those lectures. So it's great to have another one kicking off today in partnership with LATE, on which happy note I will hand over to Anne.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm chair of LATE, London Association for the Teaching of English, and if my colleague, Morlette Lindsay, were here, she would be doing this presentation. Introduction, I should say. You're very welcome. I have just met Sarah Horrocks, and they'll talk a bit about the project as they go along. Myra Bars is a great friend to us in the PGCE course in the way she talks about reading and learning to read. And we have long recommended a research project about reading and writing to our students. Sarah is the Connected Learning Center, the London Connected Learning Center. And I think I'll just leave them to explain the project as they approach it. So I'm not sure what the order of play is, but...
We'll keep you guessing with this one. We're going to go backwards and forwards. So, Sarah and I have worked on lots of projects together, and this is our most recent one. It's a project on blogging, and it was specifically set up to look at the effects of children's blogging, if any, on their writing, primary children's writing. And Sarah had the hunch that blogging was potentially a major development that could make a considerable difference to school writing. And it was, in any case, a new way, a whole new way of communicating and sharing writing with people both inside and outside the school. Parents, and indeed, as the teachers all say, the whole wide world. So what kind of impact would that have on schools? We decided to set up a small and not very well-funded research project. Thinking about this question, it's really quite easy to relate it to the reason why we're here today, which is to remember the work of Harold Rosen. Because one of the many projects that Harold himself took part in here at the Institute was what came to be called the Writing Research, an ambitious project which was set up with the support of the Schools Council to look into the development of writing abilities ages 11 to 18. This is the project report, which I've consulted many times over the year and have been revisiting lately. The project began in 1966. It continued until 1971. Initially, they collected over 2,000 pieces of writing from 500 students in 65 secondary schools, specifically from students in the first, third, fifth, and seventh years, that is currently years 7, 9, 11, and 13. These samples of writing were taken from across the curriculum, and the research team drew on those samples to help them develop an adequate multidimensional model for describing writing development. And without going into too much detail, I'll say that the team looked at the writing samples that they collected in relation to two dimensions. And the first dimension was the function of the writing. Here, the model drew very heavily on speech linguistics and categorized writing according to whether it was expressive, narrative, informative, speculative, poetic, and so on. Nowadays, it's much more common to categorize writing in relation to genre because of the writing linguisticians that have sprung up. However, it's mainly the second dimension that I want to focus on today, which is the audience dimension. The research team categorized all the samples according to their sense of audience, and they classified these audiences. They hypothesized that one of the ways in which writing develops is in a growing sense of audience and the ability to cater for different kinds of audiences, from writing for the self to several categories in school of writing for the teacher. These included writing for the teacher as a trusted adult to writing for the teacher as examiner. Harold Rosen wrote the chapter in the report about the writer's sense of audience. And he said at the beginning of the chapter, we want to suggest that one important dimension of development in writing ability is the growth of a sense of audience, the growth of the ability to make adjustments and choices in writing which take account of the audience for whom the writing is intended. And then he complicated that a little bit. In spite of the fact that the writer is physically isolated from his audience, the act of writing inserts itself into a network of social relationships which will make him say this rather than that. An invisible audience will exert some degree of control over his writing, impelling towards choices along every dimension of writing. And further on, he brings us up against the big difference between writing in general and school writing. In school, it's almost always the teacher who initiates the writing by defining a writing task. And not only does he define the task, he also nominates himself as an audience. He's not, however, simply a one-man audience, but also the sole arbiter, appraiser, grader, and judge of performance. He becomes an audience on whom pupils must focus a particular kind of scrutiny in order to detect what they must do to satisfy him. This is the teacher as examiner. In Chapter 8 of the report, we get the results of that survey. 49% of all the writing samples in the survey were judged to be written for the audience of teacher as examiner. So that's just under 50%. But over the school years, this category grew so that by Year 7, our Year 13... that's right, isn't it? No, that's wrong. So that by... Year 7 as in their category, by our Year 13. The predominant category was the teacher as examiner. The two other categories of teacher as trusted adult and teacher-learner dialogue dropped right off, and 61% of the samples were by that stage of the school written for teacher as examiner. You may not be surprised to know that the category of child to peer group was very small indeed. You might like to just guess how small it was. Well, there were only two examples in the whole sample of 2014 scripts which were judged to be written for a child to peer group. That's 0.5%. So the traffic in most of these classrooms was all one way. Harold, in discussing this category, however, suggests that one of the things that good teachers do is to make children responsive to each other's efforts. And I remember what it was like trying to provide a peer audience for children, for writing, children's writing in the age of the Gestetner duplicator, which was the only thing we had to use in order to get writing round the class. And you had to write on a purple backing sheet and then pin it to the drum of a Gestetner duplicator and then physically turn the handle of the duplicator and get out your 30 copies and then, of course, staple them all together, etc., etc., etc. And I used to do that every week because we used to have a magazine. So in thinking about blogging and writing, I think this classic piece of research can be of interest to us. It's a very intelligent and interesting book. It really still is. It shows us something about how times have changed in more than one sense. One of the striking things about this very careful and thought-through piece of work is the way in which they present their methodology in Chapter 3. I really do like methodology chapters. It's a professional deformation of mine. The assignment of writing to the categories was done by teachers, teacher assessors, and these were the instructions to the teacher assessors. They were asked to read the scripts, entering as fully as possible into the viewpoint of the writer. James Britton, who was the author of this chapter, remarks, "The process was therefore an intuitive one, an exercise in empathy." Two bad words, you see, in one sentence. Further on, he observes, "What we hoped for was something nearer to a clarification of experienced teachers' insights than to a specialist instrument designed for research purposes. This valuing of teachers' experience, this concern for the writer's viewpoint, this skillful research model which aims to capture the intuitions and insights of experienced readers and make them the touchstone of how far the writer's able to communicate ideas and feelings and interest in audience, this is a very long way from the factory model of assessment by numbers that we've been operating with in recent years. Among the implications that the researchers identified from their own research was the need for better approaches to assessment. They said, first, we need to discover ways of arriving at reliable evaluations of language behaviour that is not measurable in any simple direct fashion. We cannot go on allowing the threshold of school achievement to be kept down to the level of directly measurable language performance. And that's still a big problem for education today.
So how have technological developments changed practice in the classroom since the era when Harold Rosen was writing about audience? This year we're celebrating 25 years since Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, what he also called the Read-Write Web. And I've got a photograph there of Tim Berners-Lee with some of the children that we work with, going for a think-in at the South Bank Centre with him. In an interview in 2005, Berners-Lee was asked about what his sense of the possibilities were when he invented the web, and he answered, "The idea was that anybody who used the web would have a space where they could write, and so the first browser was an editor. It was a writer as well as a reader. Every person who used the web had the ability to write something." And later in the interview he goes on, "For years I'd been trying to address the fact that the web for most people wasn't a creative space. What happened with blogs and with wikis, these editable web spaces, was that they became much more simple. So I'm very, very happy to see that now it's gone in the direction of becoming a more creative medium." Now, he was saying that 10 years ago. We've had the World Wide Web for 25 years, and it's 10 years since weblog was the Merriam-Webster word of the year. But in UK schools in particular, it's really only the past 4 years or so that blogging in the classroom has become common practice. So how are schools using blogs? Well, often they're using them as a kind of digital magazine. They're using them as a way to communicate with parents and to show the learning that's going on in the schools. And you can see from these examples here, we've got lists of classes from primary schools, so parents can go in and have a look at what's happening in the school. Combined with that, we've got a widget here for a Twitter feed, so some microblogging showing in real time what's happening in the school on a daily basis, trips and visits and all of the learning. Then down here we've got a couple more widgets showing the visitors to the blog and showing where they come from. And this is something which really infuses and engages both children and teachers, and they're very excited about emphasising a global audience. And the children that we worked with in the study would we become very familiar with the blog statistics and could actually pinpoint people they knew. So they'd say things like, I know that those visitors from Ghana are my cousins. Or one child said, if there's friends in other countries, like my friend in Nepal, I think it's really nice. You can see what they can see what you do and how it's different to their country. But blogs do differ enormously in their scope and sophistication. And many of you in the room will be familiar with London Nautical's edutronic.net, led by Chris Waugh in the English department at London Nautical. And this provides a space for all kinds of online aspects of English learning, English themes, posting coursework, journal writing, reading reviews, film showcases. But some blogs are very tightly controlled by teachers and often largely written by teachers. They don't allow much input from students. So there's an ownership issue. Whose blogs are they? Students post themselves in some classes, and this really varies. So we've got some examples here. So three examples where the teacher's very much in control and are posting up the work that they're doing. But then down here in the corner, this corner here, we've got an example of an individual blog within a class blog, a space where this student is able to post his work. This is Luke's blog. We found the work of the US National Writing Project very helpful to us in defining digital literacy, because of course blogging has helped transform the business of writing, and it's part of also what we should acknowledge as being a general increase in writing that's come about through texting and social media and emailing, commenting. And you can see here in this definition how digital writing is a way to collaborate with other people, to mix up text together and use multimedia. And these kind of digital compositions are very much what we do at London Connected Learning Centre. We support schools and young people and children in creating these kind of digital compositions. So this week we've been working with schools, creating themed apps, helping children create mini websites, do news broadcasts. We've had an exhibition of families writing and photography, and actually today we've had 100 primary pupils at South Bank Centre celebrating 25 years of the World Wide Web.
So now we'll talk about the focus of this project. We were wanting to compare children's writing on the blog with their other writing, particularly their writing in literacy. We wanted to explore whether the writing on the blog supports children's writing in general, and we wanted to study what makes for effective practice in blogging. We should perhaps say that this project built on a scoping paper that I produced for the London CLC in 2012. That was a very broad and general look at blogging in schools, in the process of which I interviewed by phone some Lambeth teachers, and some of those teachers joined this project. The project allowed us to look in a lot more depth and over time at practice in schools. We wanted to know what was happening to children's writing on the blogs, but we also wanted to make comparisons with their other writing. And we were working with four classes from three Lambeth primaries over two terms, that was January to July 2013, and with three case study pupils in each of those classes. There was a diversity of experience among the participating teachers. A couple of them had been blogging for about 18 months, but one teacher only began blogging at the start of this project. Oh, and the classes were also different in terms of year groups. There was a year three class, a year four class, and 2 year six classes. We got to know the pupils in those classes quite well, but we looked in depth at the work of the three case study pupils in each class. Our methods were absolutely straightforward. For a small project like this, we used interviews, we used observations, structured and unstructured observations, questionnaires, and of course we look particularly closely at the substantial number of samples of writing that we gathered from the classrooms. And we also issued a general invitation to teachers internationally to complete an end-of-project questionnaire. And we shared the developing findings with the participating teachers through the project blog, but particularly at three quite substantial meetings that we had with them at different points in the project. And the teachers' responses formed part of the evidence. So I'm going to begin with one of the teachers, Harvey. He'd taken part in the previous year's survey, so he was an obvious person to involve in the project. And when the project began, he was the ICT coordinator in his school. But when he moved on to another school after the end of the project, he became a literacy coordinator. He was absolutely convinced that blogging was going to make a big difference to children's writing, and at the start of the project, he said so. I feel the blog would be a good way of showing what they've been doing in literacy. Writing was no longer in the SATs. Teacher assessment was now the only way of assessing. So this had created an area of freedom in assessment, which Harvey wanted to make the best of. Writing is the main thing for me. It's my focus in the school to improve writing through blogging. Children in my class were way below expected levels when they started in September. Writing on the blog, being part of everyday learning, will have a real impact and will improve achievement. So you can see he was absolutely convinced about this. Unlike the other three classes in the project, which all went into the school's ICT suite for their blogging sessions, Harvey's class had six computers in a kind of writing corner at the back of the class. And this meant that in the course of the week, six children at a time could work on the blog each day. And mostly what they did was respond to what we came to call Harvey's invitations, because he used to post invitations on the blog which had a literacy slant to them. We'll have a look at a couple of the literacy ones. This, for instance, was an invitation to view and then write about a really delightful film. If you haven't watched it, I do recommend you go and find it. I think it's on... What is it on? On Vimeo. Oh, yes, it says so. It's a very beautiful film, and it's emotionally, I think it's quite complex and very interesting. It's wordless, and altogether, I think it's an excellent thing to have chosen, because it's so brief, but it holds such a lot. And Harvey's invitations were always like this one, really quite to the point, straightforward and brief. Here's another one. This is what somebody's writing in response to that video. And that piece of writing for that boy was a very good piece. He was a child for whom English was a second language. He wasn't a confident writer in normal circumstances, and Harvey felt that he wrote very much better on the blog than he did in his literacy book. But this is actually quite a literary piece of narrative, I think. This is another of the literacy-related invitations. Reading this book, which is a novel about children working on a rubbish dump, you know, sorting rubbish in Manila. As part of the unit on this book, Harvey posted a clip from a video about the work of Jane Walker, who had devoted her life to helping children who work on the dumps in Manila. So they'd looked at that, and then they'd written about their responses to that. And then he invited them to write a 100-word summary of the novel. 100-word challenge is a very familiar kind of blog task, but this one is one with a reasonable point to it, it seems to me. You know, they're doing a plot summary. It's a kind of blurb. Now Sarah's going to talk about some cross-curricular blogging.
So although we were interested in comparing pupils' writing on the blog with the writing they were doing in the context of their literacy lessons, we were also really interested in how these classes were using the blog in a cross-curricular way and as a learning medium, and the way they were using it to introduce projects and record them. And the way the blog can actually create that kind of record of a display of a whole body of work over time. And I think it's very powerful to be able to scroll back over the weeks and the months and the terms over a whole year for children to be able to go back and revisit their learning, to talk about it, to reflect upon it with their teachers. This is another example from Harvey's class. So the class were doing a science topic around space explorers, and they had to do a practical activity where they had to make a rocket go move across the room out of all kinds of different materials. And they filmed this and posted it on the blog. And that then created both a record of the practical activity, but also a prompt for subsequent writing for the children. And there's an example of some of the writing. And Harvey felt really clear that this was a very good way to stimulate writing on the blog and to engage with an audience. And actually this class were involved in something called quad blogging, where they were linking with partner schools in three other schools in different countries, and the children in those schools would comment on their blog. And this was a post that they were particularly excited about, and they wanted to know how they could do the same experiment in their classes. And then another example from Harvey's class. So this was when they were doing their Galileo project. And with this example, it's the other way around. So they started with writing in their books, in their exercise books, and they had to write in roll as Galileo, arguing with the church about his theory that the sun was the centre of the solar system. So, but they knew that they were then going to perform these pieces of writing in role as Galileo. They were going to be filmed and put onto the blog. And Harvey said, the aspect of performance means the children up their game and it improves their communication. Just performing it to each other in the class, you wouldn't get such quality from them. But really this resulted in real authoritative and public styles of writing. We've got Marion with us here this evening. She was working in the Year 3 class. And Marion was very clear that in terms of building up to blogging, the same things apply to influence the quality of writing on a blog as on paper. And Marion knew that good writing on the blog was preceded by really helpful preparation, discussion about the blogging topic, oral rehearsal. And this was particularly so when children had to physically move from the classroom into the ICT suite to write on the blog. And these next few slides are showing the Vikings project that Marion's class were involved with. So over a period of weeks, they were learning about Viking journeys and gods and goddesses. They did top trump cards of the Viking gods, learned about Viking quests. They wrote their own play scripts. They had a visit from the Jorvik, a Viking from the Jorvik Centre. And then it culminated in this, the Battle of Tooting Common. And then here we've got some photographs and images from the work that they did around the plot of the gods. So they invented their own myths about the gods and acted them out. They had a dramatic storytelling, which you can see there, and Marion read Beowulf to them in a very dramatic style. And one child observed in some surprise, it didn't have tons and tons of description, but it was exciting. And Mariam said to them, your job is to make your part of the story the most exciting part. We want to be on the edge of our seats. And only after all of this work did they then go to the ICT suite to write up their episodes. And because they'd been through all of those experiences and making the comics and doing the freeze frame, the storytelling and so on, it was really easy when they actually had their half an hour in the ICT suite to write their group story. They were actually... were able to do that very, very, very well. I want to talk a little bit about writing from home. In Mariam's class, we studied a child called Helena. She was one of the case study children. And she was a child who was actually much more engaged in writing in her exercise book than on the blog. But in April, during the Viking project, she suddenly became interested in blogging from home. And Mariam had created a space on the blog called Kid Space, where children could do their own thing and make their own blog posts. And on the evening of Wednesday, the 24th of April, Helena went home, and at 7:08 she posted this. So she'd been doing her work about Vikings in class. Want to be a Viking, it's time to go and rule. Want to be a Viking, don't have to go to school. Want to be a Viking, drink buttermilk from my horn. It's great to be a Viking when you and so on. So that was just after 7:00 in the evening. And then the next morning, Helena gets up and she's back on the blog. And she's still really engaged by the Viking theme, but this time she's doing a news piece, and she's got a really accurate parody here of a news anchorman style with two presenters going between them. Hello, you're watching the VVC News with Tom Redbeard and Ruby Redsword. Today's top stories are a bunch of Danish Vikings have just took attack to Greenland. And I think these examples really show how involved Helena was with the learning that she'd been doing in the classroom, and how she could inhabit the genre. Another example from Mariam's class, this was then the class moved on to learn about teeth later in the term. And at this stage, Mariam actually set a piece of blog writing as homework, as home learning for everyone to do. And they could do a rap or a news piece or a story, a diary entry, based on the work they'd been doing about learning about plaque and healthy teeth. And this example here, the tooth football match, fantastic sports commentator genre. You know, these are year three children, young 7-year-old children, but straight into the genre. It's 3 p.m. on Saturday and we're ready for kickoff. Today, Lower Teeth FC are playing Upper Teeth FC for the Tooth Cup final at Toothville Stadium. And once again, you can see that kind of inhabiting of the genre and how, if a child is in role, they're able to write in these different genres. So this is now an example from the Year 4 class from one of the other schools. And Lou, the teacher, the Year 4 teacher, she'd actually begun her blog as a space for home learning. And it was all centred around Cuthbert the teddy bear. So the blog was actually called Cuthbert Year 4. And the children would take the teddy bear home, and when they took the teddy bear home, they would then write a blog post. And it was only later that she actually incorporated more of a kind of classwork into the blog. And at the end of the academic year, I was talking to one of the case study children, and I asked her what she was most proud of in the whole year on the blog. And she said that it was this photograph. And it was this photograph because she loved the way that she'd captured the lighting when she took Cuthbert the teddy bear to Pizza Express for her birthday celebration. So that was her favourite blog post. But she knew that actually the most popular blog post was this one. She knew from the statistics, the blog stats, that this had had the most visits, and she had lots and lots of comments from other children in her class. So she'd gone home, and just of her own accord, she'd photographed her great-great-grandparents' trunk. And there are all these different things in it. So there's if you can see, there's pipe and glasses, and there was dancing shoes, and what she called the tragic handbag. And this is a very sad story about how her great-great-grandmother had died on the way home, and nobody knew what had happened to her, and the ticket was still in that handbag, and the family have kept this handbag in the trunk as a treasured possession. I think that this work that Ella did from home on the blog shows how she understands how photography and words can support each other, and that how actually pictures can in fact structure the writing. And her blog style really represents a new kind of writing where she's writing about subjects of her choice in her personal style.
Okay, so now I want to stop the train at this point and raise a question that has been troubling me increasingly over the past 15 years or more, which relates to fundamental changes in the teaching of writing. I became aware in about 1998-99, at the time when I was engaged in research which led to the publication of a book called The Reader in the Writer, that schools had begun to teach what I can only call bad writing. And that's rather a bold way of putting it, but it is how it struck me. We were working with four Year 5 classes for this project, and in one school in particular, we found that children were being encouraged to regularly improve their writing by frequent reference to the thesauruses that were on each desk. And here's some examples of what this produced. So the first one shows, you know, the indispensable feature of good writing, the simile. And then the second one, I think, is about strong verbs. They are strong. And in general, these were the features that were supposed to be characteristic of good writing, and they were being strongly promoted by the new National Literacy Strategy, which was being introduced in that very year throughout the schools. So at the time, there was an increased emphasis nationally on writing and a concern about the difference between children's achievements in reading and in writing, as judged by National Curriculum Assessment. And the consequences, this led to increasingly urgent attempts to raise achievement through the direct teaching of the features that were thought to characterise good writing. And the consequences of that can clearly be seen in sentences like these. It often led to incongruous results in children's writing, with an overemphasis on flamboyant language and far-fetched similes and metaphors. And at around this time as well, I've been doing a bit of a history lesson for this, there appeared a publication from the QCA which made plain what official government strategy was for raising achievement. And this publication was called Improving Writing at Key Stages 3 and 4, and it was the report of something called the Technical Accuracy Project, which had done a study of linguistic features of different grade levels of writing in GCSE English. The aim of the study was to analyse the characteristics of levels A, C and F grade writing. So thus we learnt that A grade writing made greater use of abstract nouns, parenthetical commas, subordinate clauses, and place adverbials, not time adverbials, place adverbials, to link paragraphs. But F-grade candidates linked clauses by and they made little use of adjectives or paragraphing, and sparse use of commas. So this kind of information is moderate interest, but it does beg a lot of questions. For instance, David Olson points out that children of bookish parents may learn to speak with subordinate clauses, parentheticals and the like, marking structure by means of subordinating conjunctions, relative pronouns, etc. And bookish parents speak like this because writing provides a model for their speech. This is transmitted to their children, who then proceed to use that as the basis for their writing. All children use speech as the basis for their writing. There was no discussion of the content or meaning of writing in this report. It was only concerned with technical accuracy. But nevertheless, the study presents this way of looking at writing as a more reliable way of assessing effectiveness in writing than teachers' qualitative judgments. And that seems to me to be the implication of this. The process of quantifying linguistic features has enabled us to put flesh onto the qualitative judgments many English teachers habitually make, you see. So they've gone a step further in the development of writing abilities. They've actually managed to pin down what it is that marks good writing. And they follow this up with suggestions for teachers. Exercises in which, for instance, pupils are asked to calculate the proportion of abstract to concrete nouns in their writing. I don't know if anybody's ever did any of these. Or they're given a quota for paragraph linking, being encouraged to use two place adverbial links for every time link, and so on. So this kind of highly questionable pedagogy doesn't ever seem to ask whether, in fact, teaching children to sprinkle abstract nouns through their text does result in good writing. It just assumes that these are the success features, having analysed them, and that these mark high-grade writing, so using them will inevitably result in high-grade writing, QED. There is an impatience in this approach, an impatience with learning, the time it takes, the differences there are between learners. When we did the research on the reader and the writer, we were able to show in detail just how much children take from their reading and how their writing can change and develop in response to what they read. But in a world in a hurry, this approach is too slow. It's seen as much more efficient and time-saving to teach the linguistic features that characterise successful texts directly to children. We've entered into a world where we now have state-sponsored teaching to the test, and this is seen as the best or only way to raise achievement, or to be more exact, scores. Dylan Williams remarks, "Rising scores demonstrate little more than teachers' increasing ability to teach to the tests and the power of high-stakes tests to distort the curriculum." This has continued to be official policy in teaching writing. Features that tend to mark more mature writing, features that generally develop as a consequence of reading and with the development of thought, are now routinely being taught directly to children as a shortcut to higher scores. But what is the consequence of that kind of cramming? If such features are used without regard to the relevance or the appropriateness, they don't always improve writing. Instead, they often produce stilted and self-conscious writing or over-decorated texts where the focus is all on the surface of the writing and not on what the writer says. And they divert both teachers' and children's attention from the content and the meaning of the texts. Then in 2008, QCA produced the Assessing Pupils' Progress framework, which gave detailed criteria for 8 strands at each level of the National Curriculum for Writing and supported a system of assessing pupils at 3 sub-levels, low, secure and high, at each of the 8 levels, so that the 8-level scale became a 24-level scale. This framework, which was only in the first instance ever intended to be used with 4 children in the class, was initially found helpful by some teachers, but then it was simplified or crudified by commercial assessment schemes which provided boiled down versions of it. Commercial schemes have benefited very much from the general frenzy to force scores upwards. Commercial schemes claim to up-level writing by teaching children how to inflate their language and make their sentences more complex. So this is what we found in the blogging project classrooms. Not in children's writing on the blogs nearly so much, but certainly in their writing in their books. Schools were still teaching bad writing, but now it had progressed and was dominating practice. One assessment scheme called Big Writing was being used in all the schools in our project. We therefore came to call this phenomenon big bad writing. And I want just to show you a clip. Using the thesaurus was still going on, But this time, it was an online thesaurus, which was up in the left-hand corner of the screen. So you came to a word you thought was a bit too ordinary, and you clicked on the online thesaurus, and it offered you an alternative. And this produced things like the first two examples. They decided to decampment. The child had wanted to find a word that was the same as escape. So she'd used the word that the thesaurus offered. Perhaps it had said N after it, but she hadn't noticed that it wasn't a verb. She hadn't appreciated that it was escape in a rather specific kind of context. I don't know what the child that used engulfed the rope had put into the thesaurus, but the context was one where somebody in a film was holding a great big rope with both hands. And basically, the child had not been in a position to evaluate what the thesaurus was offering, and this is the whole problem. This is the whole problem. These children were convinced that exotic words were what were needed to make their writing better. Ordinary words wouldn't do. And it was assessment scheme that was being followed that led to this serious skewing of priorities. Similes were the standard way of dressing up writing, which had often incongruous results, as you can see. The last one, of course, was particularly good because it was also alliterative. Quadruple alliteration was happening in that, so that's even better. And then using adjectives and adverbs, I read buoyantly out of my house, back into the caged domain. Buoyantly is an unusual adverb, of course. And then we arrive at the caged domain, which is a rather 18th century kind of term for a zoo. And finally, we have an example of lovely descriptive writing, which is the kind of self-conscious and decorated language that gets good marks, you see. Purple writing, like this, was what was being looked for. And here's an example from Twitter, supplied by Sarah, which is a head teacher drawing attention to a super sentence. While Sally devoured her king-size baguette, her brother was obliterating a juicy burger. Okay. And this is a kind of language on steroids, which is being encouraged and celebrated in the schools. So, we got a bit worried by this point, and we decided we would ask the teachers in the project just to write down what they thought made for good writing. And this is what they said. Good writing has purpose, it tells you something new about the world, it's stylish, it never bores, it often surprises, it's readable, it must be for a real purpose, and in context, they must understand who the writing is, it's creative, it expresses something. Essentially, the writer needs to engage the reader by being fast-paced and interesting. Without a good idea or a strong plot, a piece of writing is not going to be classed as good. And the kinds of things they were picking out were content, good content and ideas, real meaning and purpose, imagination, originality, creativity, fluency and momentum, and a strong sense of a reader and an audience. So those were the teacher's themes. We had already asked the children what they thought made for good writing in one of the questionnaires, and this is what they said. It would need wow words to impress me, vocabulary that catches attention, good sentences full of adjectives. And good punctuation, of course, descriptions and similes. And then we asked the teachers to look at what the children had said. We discussed the difference between their versions of what made for good writing and what the children understood made for good writing. And they were concerned, but they were resigned. They felt that they had to teach that kind of over-embroidered style to children, because it was what the assessment scheme rewarded and it was what was expected of them. Some children did have rather more interesting and subtle responses to this question, understanding what you're doing. Good writing takes imagination, creativity and patience. You need to imagine what it looks like to be creative, what it looks like. Be creative and be patient to see how it turns out at the end, because that's the only way to have good writing. Using your own sense and imagination. And then this, rather amazing, when people are consistent, when their writing is the same quality throughout, and when this quality is more than skin deep, when there is genuine heartfelt emotion in the writing. And the last one also focuses on emotion, the emotion and the effort you put into writing. If you take the time to go to your limits, then you can do something so amazing that it will put you up levels. And in the final analysis, I think that was what both the teachers and the children's responses echoed, what mattered really, what put you up levels. We wanted in this project to look at the differences between children's writing on the blog and in their books. And here are some of the differences seen by teachers. And I just take the last couple of lines from this one and from this one. Just generally an emphasis on free, open-ended, freer environment. And here's a couple of slides about what the children said. And another slide. And I'll read the one on the right. Because when you write on the blog, you can express your feelings and write what you want to, and it's not like writing in your book. There's nothing to not like. And instead of writing in your book, you can watch videos to inspire you. We probed a little more in the questionnaire, and we asked the children what the differences were between the comments that teachers wrote on their books and what they wrote on the blogs, and this is what they said. They are very good at going straight to the point. So there were some ambiguous responses to blogging. These two respondents, children, say they prefer writing in books. The first one, however, is obviously very excited and interested by writing on the blog as well. The second girl really likes to think about her ideas beforehand and doesn't feel she has as much thinking time when writing on the blog, but she nevertheless says, Sarah's going to talk a little bit about the relationships in the blogging classrooms.
So we had this fantastic opportunity, reading the blog so regularly, to have a really close-up view on these online communities. And we witnessed this incredible sharing between the children and their teachers, a kind of parallel online class, what Henry Jenkins and colleagues call participatory culture. And we found that the class blog really did seem to improve relationships. The teachers themselves said that they actually found out a lot more about children through the blog writing. They found out more about their interests and their passions and concerns. And the children as well were incredibly engaged in what the other children had written and found this really exciting, and especially with some of the posts in terms of home learning. And that also seemed to really improve relationships. There were also comments that we heard about from parents, and parents getting really involved in their children's learning through the blog. And one of the case study children actually talked about that her father didn't live with her, but he was always looking at the class blog and finding out about what she'd been doing and what she'd been learning. And then there's also something about we talked about ownership earlier, about how the blog changed the relationship in terms of who could set the agenda in the classroom. And this next example I want to show you is from a Year 6 child in Katie's class. Katie was a Year 6 teacher. And in this, they'd been doing some work about spies, so that was their class topic. and this is Rakim, and he's making an invitation to the rest of his class to write. I was thinking to start going to the next level with the spy stuff. What I was thinking of is that I should write a story. This also applies to everyone as well. If you want to, you could write a page a day, or not, of how your spy is, or what would be really amazing if you could write a story. Not a long one. Remember, this was just a suggestion for me to know more about your spies, as I will be checking your stories. Mara's going to say a bit more about audience.
About audience, yeah. So, we've seen that peers have become a key audience in these classrooms. Children on the blog are reading each other's writing, they're commenting on it, they're being influenced by it, they're often consciously picking up on features that they admire and incorporating them into their own writing. And this kind of dialogue around text on the blog doesn't have to go through the teacher, it's direct. Children really enjoyed being read by their peers and often communicated this in the interviews and questionnaires. They appreciated being read by teachers too, though sometimes they missed the kind of lengthy comments that teachers wrote on their books, often in the role of teacher as trusted adult. But in general, the blog created a sense of audience that can only come from actually having a real audience for your writing. It created a writing community. As Sarah has been suggesting, this question of audience touches very much on the general question of the relationships in the classroom and the difference that blogging can make to those relationships. And one way of describing what can happen is that the relationships are being democratized a bit. There's more child-to-child or student-to-student interaction around writing than ever before. And another aspect of this innovation is also the changed role of the teacher. No longer the sole audience, the teacher's contributions to the blog, their comments, are, as the children so clearly perceive, different from their comments on books. The children are freer in how they write on the blog, but so are the teachers, freer to respond more as readers, less as examiners. If we go back to the Institute writing research, it's clear that there's very much more peer-to-peer writing in these blogging classrooms than was ever found or imagined at the time of the writing research. We didn't, I'm afraid, do the straightforward job of counting how many pieces of writing the children wrote on the blog and how many they wrote in their books, and we should have done that. But we are, at any rate, in a position to say that the proportion of the writing done by children for their peers was far, far higher than the 0.5% of the sample found by the writing research. I would say it was between about a quarter and a third of all the writing that the children were doing. It's also, of course, the kind of writing that happens within these more relaxed relationships that is important. The children's writing on the blog, as I think you've seen, was less inhibited and more spontaneous than their writing in their books. They were able to try things out. They weren't so conscious of levels. The blogs were not levelled, and that, of course, was very important. That created an area of freedom in the writing classroom, which was very helpful to all the children, but particularly to certain groups of children, especially, for instance, children for whom English was not their first language. Children who were inhibited in their writing because of anxieties about error could try things out and take risks writing on the blog. And that seems a very positive argument for blogging. Now we're going to look at some of the conclusions from the project. All in the wrong order. There we are. Here we are.
Classrooms, of course, have changed a lot in the past 25 years in terms of technology resources, but this does vary considerably from school to school. And we've already spoken about how sometimes moving between the classroom and into an ICT suite had a detrimental effect on the flow of children's ideas for writing. So one of our conclusions, recommendations, is really around the need to invest in technology within classrooms so that mobile devices or computers are available throughout the day to enable that kind of wider access to blogs throughout throughout the whole time in the classroom. And another recommendation that we have is relates to typing. We recommend that in the same way as with handwriting, typing really needs to be given due attention and pupils need time for practice. From our very earliest discussions with teachers in the project, they felt that children were being held back because of their lack of facility with their typing. And also our observations and discussions with children showed that they also found this difficult, and that would influence whether they felt positive or not about writing on the blog. And younger pupils, of course, found typing harder than handwriting. And we drew on the work of Medwell and Ray at Warwick University, who talk about automaticity in terms of letter production and handwriting, and how this plays a role in facilitating higher order composing processes by freeing up working memory to deal with the complex tasks of planning, organising, revising and regulating the production of text. And Lisa Nilsson from New York City Department of Education writes something similar here about typing and about how you need to have that that fluency with typing to get your ideas out.
So now we'll look at the questions that we asked at the beginning of the project. The main questions: is there a difference between children's writing on the blogs and their writing in the books? Well, I think we've seen that there is, and that both teachers and children perceive these differences. But does it have an effect? Oh, you haven't done the online survey. Did you want to do that? You might as well. Go on.
Yes, so actually some of these issues around access to technology were also picked up in the online survey that we did, and you can see there the comment from the UK teacher talking about limited access to the ICT suite. One of the questions we asked was around comparing blog writing and book writing, and this Australian teacher was quite bewildered by that because she said, well, we have one-to-one laptops, that's not an issue, all of the writing we do is digital writing. And she also makes a comment there about a visit that she made to English schools and obsession with writing in exercise books. Another theme just to pull out from the online survey was around editing, proofreading and revising. And again, we found a real difference between comments from UK teachers and teachers from other English-speaking countries. And that they seem to emphasise much more that aspect of revision on the blog.
Okay. So, does blogging help writing? This is what the teachers say. Quality of the blog post has improved. The quality of writing is starting to go up in their books. This teacher here says performance varies between the two formats. The level of writing might not be as high on the blog. That's the level as judged by the assessment scheme. Punctuation is worse on the blog. But, however, all seem to agree that it has helped them become more confident writers. It helps their writing stamina. It gives them more opportunity for writing. Some children who are reluctant are not reluctant on the blog. Everybody likes doing it. And again, I think the main improvement is their attitude to writing. They've become so much more confident with writing, both writing in their books and on the blog. And this is what the children say. And again, there's a lot of emphasis on reading other people's work, on keeping a mental note in your head to do something like it, and so on. You can see how people put their points of view. You can take note of ideas. Well, all the children did make progress on the NC levels. Interestingly, the progress they made in writing was judged to be, on the whole, as great as and sometimes greater than their progress in reading. We only had a very small sample, three children in four classes. So of those 12 children, four made greater progress in writing than in reading. But then there were some other aspects that we thought we could be fairly clear about from all the evidence that we had. The children gained a wider sense of audience and they saw their writing as communicative in nature. They developed a sense of their own voice as writers. they became more conscious writers, they were more aware that they were writing in order to be read by others. They developed wider criteria to use in judging their own writing and that of others, and they showed increased interest and engagement in writing. But there were three paradoxes. First of all, teachers said that blogging contributed to the general improvement in writing, even though the writing on the blog was not as careful or as accurate as pupils writing in their books. That was an interesting paradox, but it's easy to see how it might come about. Then, a very great deal of emphasis was placed on the potential public and global audience for the blog, but there was very little emphasis given to editing and revising blog entries in these classrooms. On the whole, they were written and they just went up. And this seemed extraordinary, given the emphasis that the international teachers had placed on editing and revision. What I think was happening was that this had become an area of freedom for the teachers and the children in these classrooms, which might have been infringed on if the teachers had started asking the children to pay as much attention to getting their work correct and drawing attention to issues of revision and editing. I think they might have lost some of that sense. I think it had a very important function for them. And then finally, global audiences are always emphasised when people talk about blogging, but the key audience for blogging, as you've seen from many of these children's quotes, seem to be the audience of their own class. That's what they really value and what they continually revert to when they're writing about the what they like about blogging, the benefits of blogging, and so on. What it's done is it's created a real writing community. Blogs created writing communities. They were live communities that were concerned with writing. They were horizontal communities. Not all the comments had to go through official channels. And it was writing, as Harvey said, without any negative connotations. He said, if you can get children to write without any negative connotations, it's a very magical thing to hold on to. They enjoy it in a way they don't enjoy other writing. I think we have to acknowledge that writing still does have negative connotations for quite a lot of children today. And one of the great things about doing this project has been seeing a real area of growth and enjoyment.